Welcome to Movie Geeks United, everybody. How is everyone out there doing? We're back tonight with another great episode, a new interview, and talk about movies that are very exciting for a lot of people.
There you go. That's the nicest way you could have put that.
Okay.
True.
So, exciting movie from this weekend, $93 million grossing Godzilla.
It's so funny, $93 million. I don't think the second and third series saw that kind of money in their lifespans from 85 to 2004.
Oh, surely.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I think is.
Yeah, you can lump all them together. Like,
I mean, it's really funny. You know, you put all the new Mad Max movie that comes out next summer will probably gross more the opening weekend than all three movies combined.
That's probably true.
They have a $67 million world gross. So this is incredible news because you just years ago you used to see, oh, we're going to try Godzilla again. It's like, oh God, how bad is this going to be? You know, the key is you kind of crib from Steven Spielberg and you crib from the older movies and you get something that is actually very memorable and decent. Jamie, you actually went out
is
and
it
saw
it. Decent? Hold on a second, though. You just used the word decent. Is it better than decent, though?
Oh, it's. I don't think Godzilla's ever looked this good in his whole life. Godzilla's never looked this good.
The Japanese think he looks too fat.
That's. Have you ever watched a Godzilla movie? He doesn't look like he's a swim fast model.
No,
he's not.
Such
a bad guy. That's the dumbest thing I've. That's the dumbest. He ain't an after photo. He's never looked like an after photo. He's always been bulky. He's always got.
He's got some pretty thick thighs. Always.
He's got cankles. He's got some cankles, baby. He's got cankles. All right. Let's just.
Okay.
This whole argument that he's overweight and fat. No, I want to tell the Japanese. Really, have you looked at your guy? I mean, even in the best of times, after the blast, even after the blast with all that heat, he never lost the weight. Even after the blast, you know, even after the oxygen destroyer, he's, you know, come on.
Yeah.
I want to first say I'm surprised that you saw it, Jamie, and that your reaction was as positive as it was.
Yeah.
No one's taking that into account. Your reaction, because you are not a Godzilla fan, am I correct in saying that?
No, I could care less about monster things. Yeah.
So your reaction is one of the nicest things that I could ever think that you would say about, because this is a Wes Anderson movie for most people. If you don't like Godzilla before this, this movie ain't going to change your mind. This is,
yeah,
this is like the Grand Buddha.
Wes Anderson's Godzilla. That would have been interesting.
Well, that would have been.
Wes Anderson's Godzilla. I want to see that movie.
But that's what it's. But in all, that's the analogy I'm making. If you don't like Godzilla, this movie ain't gonna change your mind. This movie is just not gonna do it. As far as the movies go, I think that the guys that started Toho Studios, Ishiro Honda, EJ Pastabrucha, and Tanaka would have killed to have had the budget to make this movie. They would have killed. I mean, I said that about Pacific Rim, too. I actually think this works a lot better in many ways than Pacific Rim.
I hope so.
Well, but the problem with... I need to address some things here There's been a lot of complaints that Godzilla isn't in the movie that much. If you go back and watch any of the films, the good films, the really good, like, you know, and that there aren't... There, he's not in. He doesn't show up till very late in the movie.
Yeah. Can I just address this?
Yes.
I want to address this thing. See, people nowadays are used to the monster movies in which the monster shows up early, because there was a backlash at a certain point in film history of keeping the monster away from our eyes until a certain part of the movie, a lot of the movie had been shown. So there was a certain backlash against that, you know, of like keeping the monster away. And so the movies has now gone to where they show the monster early, but keeping the monster away from our eyes is actually something that throws back to earlier monster movies, earlier monster movies in the 50s, and even in the back in the 30s and so forth.
King Kong.
Like,
no
kept,
one did it.
Yeah, they kept
King
yeah,
Kong.
Yeah, exactly, King Kong. And we'll talk about more about the relationship between King Kong and Godzilla a little bit later.
Well,
I
think I
have a question
it's
I want
very
to ask
interesting.
You, yeah.
It's very interesting, though. I mean, I do have to give props to Edwards. No one did this better than Spielberg with Jaws. Whether, you know, that is the definitive. But the movie does owe a lot to several Spielberg movies, Close Encounters, War of the Worlds, Jurassic Park, obviously. But so if you're going to crib from somebody, this is who you crib from. You know, if you're going to go after. But
so
I have
it's
to
like
think,
a
okay.
combo of the. It's a combo of the Japanese and the Spielberg-y sort of thing.
Yeah, it is. But it also owes a large amount to the Willis O'Brien King Kong, especially in the very last fight. Is as my brother Michael pointed out, is the ultimate homage to probably the greatest fight ever put on screen. I think is between in the 33 version Kong versus a T-Rex. Remember, and it is a ironically just a stunning. Beautiful homage to that. But going back to the thing, it's good that he's not in it a lot, because when you are watching the fights at the end, as exciting as they are, and we've been waiting the whole time for this, you know, it does get repetitive, like in Pacific Rim, and especially Man of Steel. The fights just get, you know, it's only so
yeah,
much
Yeah,
this
whole
take.
Thing fighting thing, you know, it's, yeah.
yeah. The other thing, though, is that the other criticism, which, you know, is a valid criticism, but he cuts away. As soon as the action gets going, he cuts away. It's what he cuts away is so much more interesting. I was watching a movie last night, one of the older Godzilla films, which is, I think, one of the best ones of the Japanese ones, the 64 Godzilla versus Mothra. But the cutaways in that are some of the worst cutaways in the history of motion pictures. So I have to give Gareth Edwards credit for at least cutting away the things that actually are somewhat more interesting than in the Japese films.
There's some actual drama and everything.
Yeah, there is an actual drama. The other thing that I guess people aren't bringing up is that in the San Francisco sequence with the bridge and the bomb and everything, is right in the Dark Knight Rises also. I mean, it's kind of another legendary production, but... and Warner Brothers, too, it also is like, wow, it's like the Dark Knight Rises in parts. If you like Godzilla, I think you'll like this movie. If you don't like Godzilla, this movie ain't going to change your mind. I really, that's how I look at it.
Well, it really sounds like the way you're speaking about it, it's an amalgamation of certain things they hope, appeals to the audience, and... And, I think Gareth Edwards is a very interesting director for the movie, and so it seems natural to me, with monsters.
He's the only person
that
I think could do it. I've had this conversation with Roland for the last couple of weeks. If you were going to, I always said in the 80s and 90s, you would get Terry Gilliam or Tim Burton to direct this movie. And now this
but
is
they
would have late.
Done it, really. Terry Gilliam wouldn't
but
have known what to do with it.
But if you would have done it back in their day, in their heydays, I think they would have been some interesting results. You would, today, I wouldn't even think about that. Do you think that Del Toro would have been the only other director I think that would be interested, could do an interesting job with this? But I think Gareth Edwards has done the best job that anyone could do with this. I really do.
But given
the previous movie, Monsters, it was a bold and good choice.
Well, what were your thoughts on it, Jamie? I mean, I haven't seen the movie, so I have no thoughts. So,
I thought that there's a review on Salon. I mean, critics have been pretty kind to it. There's a review on Salon that says it's the best summer blockbuster since Jaws. I think that's like going way overboard. And they bring up stuff
he's
like
he's hyperbole a lot. That guy on Salon.
Yeah, and he's like, and the David Strathairn character and how different he is as the man in command, and he has a conscience, and no, he doesn't really. I mean, it's all of those roles are so stock, and there's so many quality actors that are just in the movie because they want to be seen by a large audience, but they're not given anything to do. You know, the Best Supporting Actress nominee, Sally Hawkins, is in it. I doubt she even knew her character name. I mean, she's just so irrelevant.
I don't remember. What was her name?
It wasn't Sally Hawkins. And so the movie desperately wants to build empathy for its characters in the first hour, and that's the hour that a lot of people probably are going to find slow, because it does invest somewhat, but then you have an empathetic figure like Bryan Cranston who disappears, and it's taken over by that Aaron Taylor-Johnson guy who is one of the blandest actors I've ever seen. He's not somebody you want to root for or invest in. And then there's Ken Watanabe, who's wasted. All he does is, like, think really hard, and then he acts really surprised with big bulging eyes. That's his entire performance. But then the Godzilla stuff's in the first after the first hour, and, you know, it's that's what you go to a Godzilla movie for, and that's what will please the masses. I just thought these two halves of this movie were like terribly divided. Like they tried to invest stuff in the first hour, and then they said, okay, screw that, we can't keep up with that, so let's go to the Godzilla stuff.
All right, I have to say something about Ken Watanabe though. I don't think he's the closest thing we have to a Quint in this movie. Because he does, and it's a shame. I mean, he really does the scene where
That's the problem. That's the problem with the movie, and that's what separates it most from a Spielberg movie. Because everyone's talking about Jaws, or everybody's talking about Jurassic Park. Spielberg.
They're all talking about other movies.
he populates his movies with interesting, colorful people.
Right.
There's no color whatsoever to any of these people.
No, I give you that. I give you that, Jamie. I actually would give you. There aren't any the whole history of the previous films going right up until 2004. Trust me, Aaron Taylor Johnson is far more interesting than most of the characters. Trust me. For a lot of us, until recently, these movies were horribly edited on television and dubbed. So, you know, things were missing. The original Japanese versions aren't much better. I almost have to dare to say even they're very heavy-handed in their messages, especially for those ones in the 70s with deal with pollution and everything. I mean, you haven't seen. Oh, that movie, the making of that movie, I would love to see a documentary on the making of that movie when the producer, the guy who, you know, Tanaka was sick while they were making that, and when he got out of the hospital and he saw the movie, he's like, you guys will never make a movie again. You destroyed the franchise.
But I mean, you know what? The Godzilla versus the Smog Monster is one of the great titles of all time. So that's the one that you.
No, but Jamie brings up going back to what Jamie's talking about. You bring up a great. No, no one does this like Spielberg. Spielberg does this mixing of the, you know, the big extravaganza and the effects and the personal story and the characters. No, no one does that like him. He really has managed to just make that his own.
Well, the thing about Spielberg is he doesn't have to – his name allows him to not really have to rely on market forces. In other words, the marketers or the people who are concerned with marketing in the executive offices aren't really – concerned with, you know, they have Spielberg, so that's it. And so they don't have to, like, concern themselves with trying to get in as many, like, tips of the hat to other movies, you know.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about tipping a hat to, you don't have to worry about tipping the hat to Jaws, because you wouldn't have to worry about that because it's Spielberg, but you wouldn't have to worry about, tipping their hat to The Dark Knight and putting an element of that in there or anything like that. So if Spielberg were directing something like this, it would seem, you know, rather more original.
He did with Jurassic Park, and I did, like, I mean, My initial criticism of Jurassic Park, and I already came home and told my friend Eric Turnauer, there weren't enough there wasn't enough dinosaurs in it, and you know that, and I guess you know that was at the time kind of a common, you know, not that it's a bad movie, it was just, you know, a criticism, you know, oh, there weren't enough dinosaurs in it. And the other criticism, if you notice by a lot of mainstream critics, there, a lot of people liked it, but they said, you know, all he, Spielberg, has done is made a very expensive Destroy All Monsters movie, in one sense, was one of the things thrown at it. And it's ironic that this guy has made a Godzilla movie that is more in tune with Jurassic Park, you know, or wants to be. But there's so many other awesome movies to talk about. There is Chef, and I think that is the, you know, the really the feel-good film of the year so far. This is the new Jon Favreau movie where he plays a distinguished Los Angeles chef who, you know, gets a bad review from a critic and sends his life into a tailspin. He has to go on this kind of like vision quest, and it's superb. It's super. This movie is just incredible. I mean, it's got a great supporting cast. John Leguizamo, Bobby, the guy from The Sopranos, what's his name? Bobby, and he's also in Blue Jasmine. Help me out, guys.
Cannavale.
Bobby Cannavale.
Thank you. You guys, I love you guys. And, you know, let's see, Scarlett Johansson's in it. Robert Downey Jr. has an extended cameo in it. And it's a wonderful film. I mean, it's just such a great film.
It won the audience award at the Tribeca Film Festival. I know.
Oh, it did? Okay, you gotta forgive me. I didn't keep that track of Tribeca, but it's a wonderful movie. I mean, I really think, you know, we don't really, because he's such a big name director in one sense with the Iron Man movies and Elf and Doug's Cowboys
nice
and Aliens.
Well, nice to see him return back to to more indie movie territory.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's weird you say it, but you're absolutely right. I mean, this definitely goes back to Made, and let's not beat around the bush. I'm convinced that he really had more of a hand in directing Swingers than Doug Liman. I think he probably, you know, called a lot more shots there than we want to, than anybody wants to admit. But it's a really good film. I mean, you have a smile on your face the whole time watching it. When you leave, you're just like, wow, that was so uplifting, so good. And the other movie, you know, Dean, that I saw last week that I told you about is a movie that you saw, and I think it stars one of our great actors, Tom Hardy, and it's called Locke.
Mm.
And how he didn't get hemorrhoids making that movie, I'll never know. That movie blew chunks. And I did not know this, and I know you probably said this when you were talking about it, that it was directed by the guy who wrote Eastern Promises and Dirty Pretty Things.
No, actually, I did not know that. I did not know that it was directed by that guy.
Well, I saw that yesterday.
Yeah.
When we were at the theater, we were watching Chef, and I saw that in the poster, and I was like, you mean to tell me the guy who directed this, who wrote these wonderful films, didn't learn a goddamn thing about directing from Cronenberg or Stephen Frears? What the hell? I had a meltdown in the theater.
You had the same reaction that I did, really, which was just me just like sitting there like, well, of course, when I watched the movie, I didn't know anything about it. So I was like, okay, well, I know that Tom Hardy is in it. I know that it's called Locke. That's all I know. I didn't look at the poster. I didn't look at all of that stuff. But, so I'm sitting down watching the movie, and it's a guy in a car, and you're just sitting there watching it. And just like 20 minutes in, I was like, okay, so he's in the car still. Is anything going to happen here? And then,
like 40 minutes in, 60 minutes in, 80 minutes in,
I slapped. He was still in the car, and no one had stopped him. He never even stopped at a traffic light. There wasn't an accident on the road, nothing. And he never got out of the car. And then 80 minutes in, where it had still about maybe 15 minutes to go, 80 minutes in, I fucking slapped my head, and I said, oh, my God, when is this thing going to end? When is this going to end? This,
well,
this
I knew more
much.
Than you did when I walked into it. I knew that you hated the movie, and I knew that Joe Morgenstern of the Wall Street Journal loved it. So I'm thinking, and I'm watching this, I'm thinking, does Joe not drink enough? That's all I kept thinking. Does Joe need another drink before he goes in to watch the movie?
Why would anybody like that movie? What, can you figure out any reason why anybody would like that movie, Jerry?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm sorry. I keep, it was funny because the other day, that's at our Landmark Theater, our local Landmark Theater. So I was thinking, I just saw a movie here. I just went, Locke. Yeah, that's why I can't really remember it. I don't want to remember it.
Yeah, because you tried to block out the memory of Locke. They should call Locke Block. It should be Block. You should block any memory of anything that you saw in this movie out. Should be
right,
Block
right, right.
with an E at the end of it. because it is one of the... And anybody who likes it, I'm just going to be, totally questioning my opinion of that
right,
person
right, right.
from now
of
on. I just don't see any... It wasn't funny. It wasn't dramatic. It wasn't interesting. It was visually dull. Tom Hardy is okay in it, but you just sit there wishing that you could see another movie with Tom Hardy in it all the way through. And
Larry the Cable
Guy
could have been in it, for all I care.
Yeah. So that might have been Larry the Cable Guy would have made it a little bit more interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, I've just been watching like you. I've been watching a lot of TV shows because I've been personally ensconced in a little personal project here. I'm getting ready to move out of my place here in Atlanta, and I'm going to be moving into my family's home mm-hmm. in another part of Atlanta. And so that's taken a lot of work, getting the home put into shape, which it is. It is, ready to move into. Still a lot of detail work to be done, but that's pretty much done. But when I get home from that work or whatever, I tend to gravitate towards TV shows rather than movies because movies require a little bit more work than TV shows do. And TV shows are somewhat more comforting than movies can be at those times.
Mm-hmm.
So the two TV shows that I've been watching this week, which are quite different from each other, the first one is Pee-wee's Playhouse. I've been watching a lot of Pee-wee's Playhouse because I've never seen many of the episodes of that show. So so I've been watching the first two seasons of that. And what an extraordinary show that is. It's fascinating in the terms of, there probably hasn't been a kids' TV show ever in the history of,
sure.
just have to think about it a little bit more, but a live-action kids TV show that has as much care given to its production value and its writing ever. I don't think, the show was a record breaker in a lot of terms for winning a ridiculous number of daytime Emmys when it was on the air, and and for its writing and direction and for its production value as well, and probably I'm sure Paul Reubens won a couple of Emmys at least for it. But what's interesting about the show too is that it really informs you about film history as well, because There's those moments where they break away to instructional films from the 50s or or they'll break away to cartoons that were done in the 30s or whatever. And these kind of pieces don't really get shown quite a bit. You know, a lot of the cartoons they showed were probably in public domain or so forth, but you really get a sense of film history while you're watching it. And plus, There's also some of the actors that are on it, there's William Marshall, who comes mm-hmm. in as the King of Cartoons, and of course he was Blackula That's right, Shakespearean actor. That is Shakespearean actor as well. And then there's Essa Paetha Murkison, who's on a TV show now. I think she's on one of the NCIS's or one of the Law and Orders or whatever. But and then there's also Larry Fishburne, who comes on as Cowboy Curtis. And of course, everybody knows Larry Fishburne from, you know, Apocalypse Now or from the Matrix series. And, you know, I mean, it's just a really wonderful little show, you know. I mean,
right. No, it was way ahead of its time.
What show was that?
Pee-wee's Playhouse. Pee-wee's Playhouse is just a great little show.
I live about an hour and a half from Pee-wee's Real Playhouse.
Right. That's right. I was in Florida.
Yeah, Sarasota adult,
in Florida.
Adult theater. We don't have those anymore.
Is that still there?
Well, I drive an hour and a half. Like, I drive an hour and a half all the time to go to the adult theater.
I have no idea where it is.
There are no adult theaters here anymore. They closed them all down, some of which they closed down. I guess churches bought a lot of them and refurbished them as churches. It's very puritanical.
Not just the fried chicken place.
that would be the same clientele. They're actual steeple.
An actual steeple. All of those places have steeples, I'm sure. But anyway, the other show that I've been watching this week, which is
I want to go back to the adult theater in Florida. That's what I want to get.
The other show that I've been watching this week, which is an extraordinary show, probably one of the greatest shows ever in the history of all of world television, I would say, is Two Fat Ladies. And Two Fat Ladies, if you don't know anything about it, it was a show that was done in the mid-90s by BBC. They on it are the two fat ladies of the title. That's Jennifer Patterson, who passed away in 99 at age 71 or so, and also Clarissa Dixon Wright, who passed away not too long ago, probably about 2 or 3 months ago. But this is a wonderful, wonderful cooking show, to tell you the truth, but it's more than that. It has these two women driving around all of Britain on their motorcycle with a sidecar. You know, Clarissa's in the sidecar and Jennifer's on the motorcycle, and they drive all through Britain, stopping in different parts of the country to cook for, you know, one episode they'll be cooking for nuns, and one episode they'll be cooking for loggers, and one episode they'll be cooking for, you know, scouts or for cricket players, or sometimes they'll just go to a different part of the country and focus in on a certain item like vegetables or meats or so forth, or potatoes or something like that. But, you know, I don't want to characterize it as just a cooking show. That's a major part of it. Each episode is only 30 minutes long, and there's only 26 episodes out there. They only did it for 4 series, you know, and that went up to 26 episodes. But one of the major parts of couple of the major elements of the show that swirl in with the cooking is these women's extraordinary lives. I mean, they had extraordinary lives before they embarked on this project. And so you hear a little bit about their lives without, you know, and they're extremely funny. I mean, the banter between them while they're cooking and the and the songs that are sung, there's a great musical element that comes through with Jennifer Patterson's, you know, abilities to come up with songs that relate to the food and so forth, and just, you know, I mean, they'll quote Shakespeare while they're cooking and so forth, and then there's the beautiful, absolutely wonderful direction by Patricia Llewellyn, who directed all 26 episodes of the show. There's that beautiful direction that just gives you the sense of it being a travelogue about the different areas of Britain. So there, and all of the UK, because they go to Scotland and Ireland as well. And it's just the combination of comedy, cooking, and the travel, the fellowship between those two women. It's just extraordinary. So if you've never seen Two Fat Ladies, and if any of this sounds interesting to you, please take a look at it. It's one of the most relaxing, absolutely, it makes you feel great, and it really teaches you something about food and about life and everything. It's just beautifully produced, just wonderfully edited and shot. It's wonderful, absolutely superlative television. And there's just absolutely nothing like it in the entire medium. So I highly recommend to everybody listening, Two Fat Ladies. It's out there, and it's probably pretty cheap. And they became worldwide stars because of it, all over the globe, at that late date in their lives and careers. They became huge superstars. So Two Fat Ladies, great show.
Sounds good. Yeah,
as Dean says, it's out there and it's cheap. Two Fat Ladies.
Yeah,
is that their slogan on the show?
We're
out there.
Well, the ingredients to the food aren't cheap, but the DVDs are.
Okay, so let's get to our interview tonight, Dean. You had the tremendous pleasure of speaking with Bill Plimpton, world famous animator, correct?
Yeah. I got to talk to him at the Atlanta Film Festival. I talked to him after his talk with the he gave a little seminar, a 2-hour seminar to the attendees at the Atlanta Film Festival. And this 2-hour seminar was talking about his history in his history as a illustrator and as an animator, and then moves on, and he would do drawings live as we were watching. You know, he would had a big pad there and just did them with a marker and so forth. He gave everybody in the audience a custom made drawing, you know, that came up and said something, said hello to him or whatever, and it was just a wonderful that he gave, and this guy, he's been working in animation since the mid-80s,
mm-hmm.
Got an Oscar nomination for his first short film, which was called Your Face, and which was played a lot on MTV, as with many of his other short films, and he's just had he's met a lot of the major animators in the business, and so our talk, which happened after his seminar, but before the premiere of his new movie, which is called Cheatin', talking to him before I'd seen this new movie, but I'd seen some of his other movies before. Our talk, you know, happened between the premiere of his new movie, it's the South Eastern premiere of his new movie, and I spent some of the time talking about his new work, but I also spent some time, as you'll hear, talking about the history of animation a little bit, including I gave him a list of 10 animators to talk about, which you'll hear in just a second. So
wow.
So here's Bill Plimpton talking about his new movie, which is called Cheatin', and which, by the way, I should say, he's looking for distribution for, and he has a unique sort of problem with distribution of his movies, which he'll talk about in this interview. So here it is.
just got out of your talk.
Yeah,
your master class. Now, do you go around and do this to all the film festivals that you go to?
Film festivals. I do it at Pixar. I've done it at Disney, DreamWorks, Blue Sky, Europe, all through Europe I've done it. So it's something I love to do, and it's people seem to love it.
Oh, God. I mean, you imparted so much great information, not only about your career, but about giving animators, you know, very, very sage and simple advice, you know, very simple advice. It wasn't like ridiculously nuts and bolts and sort of like...
Well, I don't know the technology, so I don't know what programs we use. I just like to talk about the creative side.
Yes.
And the business side, you know, how to sell your films, how to make money on your films.
Right.
Which I think is very important.
Right, absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about cheating first.
Okay.
You talked about like how you really wanted to do an adult.
Yes.
That's kind of your goal, is to do adult animated films.
Well, my goal, I've done 7 animated adult films. My goal is to get wide distribution on the film, and that's the hard part, because in America, it's very keyed to children's films and computer animation. And for some reason, the theaters and the distributors don't believe there's a market for handmade, independent adult films.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this film is the opportunity to break that stereotype, that those barriers, that glass ceiling. Because everywhere we go, it's been winning awards, a lot of prizes, audiences love it. It's great storytelling. You know, the example I use is Quentin Tarantino makes cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
They're just with real actors. I make cartoons with cartoon characters. And it's the same kind of audience, same exact audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think this thing, this film, Cheatin', potentially has a really big audience out there.
Could you talk about the story of Cheatin'?
Sure.
What it's about?
Let me go back and tell you about the inspiration.
Okay.
I'll be telling about this tonight. I had a girlfriend about 15 years ago, and I thought this was the one true love. This is the woman I'd spend my life with. However, once we moved in together, things started going bad. Little fights, little squabbles, and it just escalated worse and worse. And at some point, I felt like I wanted to strangle her, but yet at the same time, I wanted to have sex with her. And I just sort of loved that dichotomy, that in the same person, you can love them so much and yet still hate them.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that would be a funny idea for a film. So when I came up with this idea, I thought, you know, let's make a couple that fall madly in love.
Yeah.
They are totally in love. But people on the outside are jealous.
Mm-hmm.
They want a piece of Jake and Ella, too. So they try to break the couple up. And they succeed. And Jake and Ella try to kill each other. And yet at the same time, she loves him so much, Ella loves Jake so much, that she still wants to have sex with him.
Mm-hmm.
So she can't decide whether to kill him or to have sex with him. And they kind of melds together, you know, the sex and the love and the violence kind of come together. And that's basically the story of the film.
Now, it took you a little bit longer to do this film than your other films.
Yes.
And so why was that exactly?
Well, a couple things. The technique is a lot more detailed than my other films.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the drawings are, there's a lot more drawings this time. There's 40,000 drawings, which is a lot of drawings. And I did every drawing myself. Also, the technique is a watercolor technique done with digital computers. And so that took a long time. But also, about 2 years into it, these French distributors came to me and said, you know, we think this film's going to be a huge success. We want to get some French money to make it the best you can make it.
Mm-hmm.
So they looked around for about 2 years looking for French money. It didn't happen. And so I said, screw you. I got to finish this film. I can't wait any longer. So there was a 2-year hiatus right in the middle of it. So all in all, it took maybe 3.5 years, maybe 4 years to make, but it started in 2008, and I just finished it just recently.
So was this your first, like, foray into real computer, incorporating computer?
No, the film I did previously, Idiots and Angels, we colored that with computer. That's more of a film noir look, kind of a dark brown, dark gray kind of look. This one has a lot more color. It's more vivid. It's a lot more bright. So the computer animation was a lot more intensive.
We hired,
I think, four or five more colorists to help complete the film on time. It's kind of a film noir. I don't know if you're familiar with James M. Cain.
Yeah, sure.
Who did Double Indemnity, Postman's Twice. So it's about these lovers who turn out to hate each other and try to kill each other. It's very film noirish. It kind of takes place in the 40s and 50s. The cars are kind of retro.
Mm-hmm.
The clothes are retro. The buildings, the architecture is retro. And I kind of like that. It's almost like a timeless place that could be in a fantasy.
Could be
or
in
a
the
movie.
Future, almost.
Yeah, but
it feels like the past. I love those kind of things, like Brazil and stuff like
exactly.
that. You know what I mean?
No, I think movies have an obligation to take you to a place that you've never been to before.
Yeah.
But yet it's totally fascinating. It's totally intriguing. It's some place that, or like David Lynch, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, it's another world.
Mm-hmm.
It's another time and place. So that's what I want this film to be, a really unique world that you are dying to go to,
mm-hmm.
and you really want to hang out and meet all the people and get to know them.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I want to talk to you about is sort of a little bit of the history of animation
mm-hmm.
in some ways, because I'm
sure.
interested in some of your influences. So, so I came up with maybe 10 artists, and I wanted to get your impressions. Of
sure.
these artists. I thought this would be fun to talk about. So the first one I wanted to bring up is John Kanemaker. You've had some dealings with him
yes.
in the past. I mean,
mm-hmm.
so what are your impressions of him? I mean,
John Kanemaker is very important to animation, as you know. The books he's written are some of my favorite books, and he is a wealth of knowledge about animation scholarship and history and Disney Studios. And he's been very helpful, sometimes not so helpful. I did this Winsor McKay film,
uh-huh.
and he was not supporting it. I wanted to resurrect Winsor McKay's last film, The Flying House, which is a wonderful film.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted John to comment on it, on reviving this film. And he said he didn't want to have anything to do with it. So, you know, he's got his own agenda, and that's fine. But
mm-hmm.
I think this film really helps bring the genius of Winsor McKay, who is, I think, one of the greatest animators ever lived.
That was another name on the list.
Okay. Winsor McKay is on the top of the list. Him and Walt Disney and Tex Avery are the tops of the list.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. How about the Hubleys?
The Hubleys?
Yes.
They are great.
John and Faith.
They are great artists. John is a genius.
Mm-hmm.
He was a genius.
Mm-hmm.
Their films really showed off the independent spirit when
mm-hmm.
there really wasn't much independent animation going on.
They were
on.
Kind of real groundbreakers. I mean, they were kind of one of the first animators to actually break through into the Oscars, in the short film category.
In a big way, too, because in the previous Oscars, it was always Disney or Warner Brothers. And so when the
a little bit of UPA or whatever.
UPA. So when the Hubleys came in, they really changed all the rules, and now you see a lot of wonderful independent films in the Oscars, and the Hubleys really broke that
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
I love their movies. Okay, this one's a more recent animator, and it's Scott Hirschfeld.
Yeah. He's a rock star. He's a total rock star.
Right?
I've been to his shows, and he's got mobs of fans. They line up down the street. They pay a lot of money to see his shows. And rightfully so. He's really a genius. Now, I do have a bone to pick with him, because I think his earlier films are genius, and his more recent films a little more intellectual, a little bit more
artistic. Rambling, I think.
Yeah,
a little bit more rambling and less to the point, I think.
But people love his stuff, so who am I to criticize?
And I mean, it's kind of fun to see him doing other things.
Yeah.
So I mean, I dig that too. I love his work. He's Don Hertzfeld, by the way, won an Oscar a few years ago for a film called. Was he just nominated? I thought he won for Rejected.
No.
Okay. Well, he needs to win one.
Yeah, he does.
He should have won. he's great. He works with a lot of sort of stick figure-y types of things, but it's much more complicated than that. But okay, you met some Dave Fleischer.
Yes, yes. Yeah, they're big influences on me because of their craziness, their surrealism, their humor, the dark humor, the music they use. You know, the Cab Calloway and Betty Boop stuff had great music. They used a lot of violence with Popeye, which I love. And they were really trippy. Some of their films were just so spacey.
Yeah, when you go back and look
like
at, what was
drugs.
It, Bingo? Or was it,
yeah.
When you go back and look at, I was just looking at some of those the other day, and I was like, wow, these are so weird, you know?
They must have taken a lot of drugs. Cocaine was big back then. I think they did that.
Maybe. I was watching the other night, by the way, I watched The Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that yet?
I have.
What did you think of that?
It's not my cup of tea.
Really?
Yeah, I liked the Waltz with Bashir. I think that was a great film. This film, I got lost. I didn't know what reality I was watching, and I didn't like the animation so much. And I know the animation was purposely supposed to be bad, but it wasn't pleasant to watch.
I think that speaks to my opinion that this is going to be a very divisive movie, because I was incredibly moved by it.
Oh, good.
I was incredibly moved by it to the point where I was actually weeping.
Oh, wow.
Because I think I got it.
Yeah, you did.
I got it. It's a movie that's meant to be seen, I think, a few times.
I don't think
times.
I want to sit through another time, though. That's the problem.
Really?
If I didn't like it the first time, I don't know if I want to sit through it again.
Oh, come on. Give it another shot.
I probably will.
Okay. This gets into... We'll get into Terry Gilliam.
Well, he's one of my mentors. I ran into him at the... Dubai Festival, and we were drinking, and he said, "Oh, Bill Blimpton, wow!" And I showed him some of my drawings, and he was really a big fan of my artwork, which I love because he's such a genius. And he was wonderful enough to produce my Idiots and Angels movie, so it was really great to have him on my side. And he's a very generous guy. I mean, he's so helpful about, you know, giving his name or his help or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we all love Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
This is a name that you mentioned in your talk, and I wanted you to also talk about The Three Rules. Marv Newland.
Yes. Yeah, Marv is one of my godfathers. I think one of the first independent animated films I'd seen was Bambi Meets Godzilla. Now, I'd seen all the Disney and all the Warner Brothers and MGM films, Tex Avery and stuff. I'd never seen an independent film before. And that blew me away that I could make my own film without going to Hollywood and working for the big studios. And that's one of the things that he showed me. Marv. And then Marv's just been really supportive of my work. And, you know, we hang out and drink a lot together. And he's just a good guy.
Yeah. So you said in the talk that, you know, it cost him $500 to do...
12 drawings,
$500 to do Baby Meets Godzilla. And you said that by now it's made like $100,000, and it just keeps rolling on like
another,
a steamroller.
Another film he's made that doesn't get as much publicity, and I think is really genius, is Black Hula.
Mm-hmm.
So if people out there are interested, they should check out Black Hula by Marv Newland.
I've never seen that one either.
It's a gorgeous film.
Yeah. The last name that I'm going to mention is a person that I really only know from one film, and one film only, and it's called Frank Morris.
Yes, Frank Morris.
Well, I was curious what you thought about that
film.
Well,
Frank's film is a great film. It's a genius film. It's, for people who don't know it, he clipped out catalog pictures of objects, everyday objects, and animated one on top of the other.
And then there's two soundtracks going on. There's one where he's narrating his life, a version of his narrating his life, and then the other soundtrack is just all words that start with F.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot about that. But yeah, he's really good. He hasn't done a lot of films now. He's raising dogs. He's breeding dogs now.
Oh, really?
So it's kind of sad to see this guy who's so genius. He did win an Oscar.
Yeah.
To not pursue animation as a career.
It's almost like he just gave it all to that one movie.
I think
it's obvious that's true. That he put it all in that movie, and that's one of the great movies. Unfortunately, it's hard to find. You know, you can't find it on YouTube unless
Really?
Like, Well, I looked for it once, and sometimes it gets taken down, so I'm wondering, like, why, you know,
yeah.
But I don't get it. And then every once in a while it'll pop up in a very low-quality version.
Well, I have a news flash for your audience. This is the first time I've said this, that I've been holding back my films from the Internet simply because I couldn't see where the revenue was coming from, and I was too busy selling my films to TV and to non-theatrical. And I was making more money there than on the Internet. But now I've decided that the pendulum has swung,
mm-hmm.
and there are revenue streams
available
on the web. And so we are about to release all my films on the Internet.
Wow.
So in the past, it's been very hard to see my films on the Internet, but soon they'll be all over the place.
Mm.
And I think that's an important move, important step to also help publicize the feature film Cheat.
I also wanted to talk about the pilot that you showed a clip of.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, that's something I did about 2 or 3 years ago. It's called Tiffany the Whale. It's about a female whale, who falls in love with a male model and moves to New York to pursue the love affair with this male model. Conrad is his name. And so she has to be a high fashion model to get together with Conrad. And
mm-hmm.
so I did a pilot. I have a 300-page storyboard. It's all ready to go. I just don't have the money or the time right now to start production on it. It'll be a series. It'll be a TV series, sort of like 3 or 4 minutes per episode,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. But it's all ready to go.
Mm. Well, I thought it was hilarious, the clip that you showed. But I think everything you do is hilarious, frankly.
Well, I do have, I know there's questions on there, but I know we're getting close to running out of time.
We can go a little bit later.
I do have two new projects
that
I can announce. One is a Hitler film.
Is that what it's called?
Hitler's Folly.
Okay, Hitler's Folly.
And it's a fake documentary, a mockumentary, about Hitler. What would have happened if his art career really took off,
and
he became a cartoonist like Walt Disney.
Wow.
He built Nazi land and, you know, had special uniforms.
That's a great idea.
Created a cartoon character that he loved, and, you know, a Mickey Mouse type character.
That's a great idea.
And then the other one, and that was almost done. The Hitler film should be done in about two months, I think. It's
mm-hmm.
really close to being done. And then the second film is with Jim Lujan, Lujan.
Mm-hmm.
You can find his stuff online. He's a wonderful writer and voice artist. And we decided to work together, one of his scripts. And it's a feature film. And it takes place in the barrio of L.A., the sort of underbelly of the culture, you know, with Mexican wrestlers and gangsters or you know, rap. Bail bonds guys, private detectives, hookers, prostitutes, strippers, you know, that whole thing. So it could be pretty wild. It's a very wild film.
That sounds great. One thing I did want to touch on the three rules.
Yes.
You know, the Plimpton's three rules of the dogma, the Plimpton dogma,
yeah.
which I thought these were great.
Thank you.
So go ahead with the three rules. Number one.
Rule number one is make your film short.
Make it short.
5 minutes. Don't make it any longer. No one's going to want to buy a film that's 10 minutes, 15 minutes long. There's no market for it.
And it'll be, you know, if your ultimate goal is to get your film, like, I mean, you know, shown at the festivals
right.
or whatever and bought, but also, you know, if there is revenue stream from YouTube,
mm-hmm.
people will take more time to watch a 5-minute movie
Absolutely.
Than they will anything else,
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
And all of these rules speak to that, by the way. Okay,
yeah.
So number two.
Make your film cheap.
Yeah, make it cheap.
About $1,000 a minute is the proper price. But now with the digital technology and flash, you know, it's pretty easy to make it a cheap animated film. My films are about $1,000 a minute. Guard Dog, which is 5 minutes long, costs about $5,000.
Mm.
So it's much easier to make your money back if your budget's low. And then the third one is make it funny.
Yeah.
And if it's funny, if people laugh, everyone's going to want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's going to want to show it. Everyone's going to want to buy it. It's just so much easier to sell.
But if it's 20 minutes and it's not very funny or whatever,
mm-hmm.
it's
impossible to sell.
You might win an Oscar, maybe,
yeah.
but you won't get a lot of people
yeah,
to watch
you
it.
You won't make your money back.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I have to make my money back simply because You know, I have to pay for my studio, I have to pay for the employees, the materials and everything, so I need money to continue making my films.
Well, I think the three rules is actually a really good place to stop here. I know that you're hungering to get in there to watch some animation that maybe you've never seen, and hopefully you're going to see some things that are short and funny.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to see that.
So I'm going to let you go, but I want to say it's been a real thrill to talk to you.
Okay, that's Bill Plumpton. The new movie is called Cheatin'. So it's making the Cheatin' is making the rounds at festivals now?
It's making the rounds at film festivals around the world at the moment. And as I said, he is looking for more of a theatrical distribution for this. It's kind of a personal sort of quest for him to see more adult related animated films movie screens. So, and we might have him when it comes closer to its release date. We'll probably have him on the show again and talk to him further about things. But you can look for cheatin.com. I think it's cheatin.com. I'm not sure, but you can definitely look for Bill Plimpton and Cheatin' and get to his homepage to learn more about where it is and so forth.
This silly thing that Star Wars has officially begun shooting. You know, J.J. Abrams posted that photo of from the studios with the slate and everything, first day of shooting or whatever. I mean, if that even counts as news. There's a lot of stuff going on at cons this year, though. A lot of interesting stuff.
Oh, yeah. How is Ken going on? I mean, like, what's going on with Ken so far
is that our friend, or I say this because we interviewed him, but I would always wanted to consider him a friend since King of New York. Abel Ferreira's new film, Welcome to New York, is getting a lot of press. This is about the, what's his name, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, is that DSK?
It's the movie about the party guy.
With Gerard Depardieu and Jacqueline Bisset, and this film is making the rounds there and all sorts of controversy. And you got to forget, I'm just going, you know, looking for information on this whole thing. That's one of the films I know, and also The Grace of Monaco had its official premiere.
How was that received?
Not very well.
I wouldn't think so.
I didn't think that would be received very well as it was, but it's worse than you would think. I'm not sure.
Can I just say this about the Grace of Monaco movie? To me, Nicole Kidman is completely miscast in that role. She's completely cast because of her name. But you know who would have been perfect in that role? This is going to sound crazy, but January Jones from Mad Men.
Physically, yes. I don't know whether she could carry the part, but I have to really honestly, when you're talking about Grace Kelly, I can't think of anyone. She was so beautiful and everything. I can't think of anyone really. If I was an actress, if I was a woman, I would not want that role.
It would be like asking somebody to play Marlon Brando or something. Like, how the fuck are you going to play that?
Well, I could play Marlon Brando in the chubby phase, no problem. I mean, I can do like the freshman, I could do the scene in the movie in the biopic.
Come on, you're way too ripped to play the Marlon Brando.
The first 30 years of my life, I could have played where he, and you know, remember in his autobiography where he would ask the kids to go buy him cheeseburgers during the whole Christian Brando fiasco? He would ask kids to go, but can you get me some
stuff at McDonald's, please. I could do that part. No, I could do that part perfectly. But you got to forgive me. It sounds like this year's a lot of fun. I think Sasha Stone, she saw the Cronenberg movie there, Map to the Stars, and she loved it. I mean, going by her Facebook page, she really loved that movie.
You know, the one that's gotten rotten reviews is the Adam Egoyan movie, The Captives, with Ryan Reynolds. And
Yes.
Something's happened.
That's based on, like, the whole thing in Robin Hood Hills, the whole
no, that's
Paradise Lost thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Wait, let me ask you a question. Is that not the same film as Devil's Knot?
No, I'm telling you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, that,
okay.
That movie, they're two different movies. That's
okay,
Devil's
Knot. Sorry, I didn't know that.
Devil's Knot came out last year, and it's on demand this week.
I watched
that last night, and it's terrible. But the new movie is called The Captives, The Captives, and it premiered at Cannes, and it's about, I guess, a missing girl and a family that tries to find her. But they say it's just awful. So twice in a row, at least, I can't remember what he did right before that, he's been getting, like, these rotten notices, and which is terribly odd for the Adam Egoyan we used to know.
Yeah, I didn't realize that he had another film after Devil's Knot. You've got to forgive me. I didn't know that. I'm sorry. I did not know that.
And his next movie is called Don Knotts, and I don't think that that's going to be a burn burner
either.
I
can't wait to
see Adam Egoyan Don Knotts.
So he did that movie with he did Chloe.
And then he's moving on
Chloe
to the feature-length version of Knott's Landing. I think that's an awful
weird
choice as well.
I want to see that. But I would like to see that. But he did Chloe, if I'm not mistaken, right? Chloe with Julianne Moore.
Chloe, yeah.
And then there's another one before that, which was actually the one that I think we interviewed his composer for.
Michael Dana.
And that was the last thing I saw by him in my life. But I didn't realize that there was a brand new film. Okay, wow.
Lo and behold, I got it like an email like popped up on my Facebook this morning that said, "Thank you for contacting us. We are based in London, so the time difference might be an issue." And that was from the Shining Twins.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Somebody that I've tried to track down for years to no avail. So I've tracked them down, and I've got a response from them. So when I say, you know, the time difference will be no issue whatsoever, I'll wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, whatever you guys need.
Oh, definitely.
So I can talk to you guys. So,
I can help you with that.
We could have the Shining Twins. And then, you know, I'm still trying to break down Vivian Kubrick like Scientology did. So hopefully I can get an interview with her, too.
Maybe you got to give, you know, a few pairs of eyes on her to do that. surreptitious guys in glasses hanging around.
Vivian Kubrick took to Twitter and started her own account, but there's no way to message her. Even if you friend her, there's no way to message her on Twitter. You just got to tweet her, but it sounds so filthy. But she posts old pictures, like family photos and stuff, on her profile. It's neat. Speaking of the Kubrick series, there's something exciting. I got an email the other day. There's a group. There's something like meetup.com where people of similar interests get together and they decide to meet up, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't understand this whole social media thing. Excuse me. So they started up this meetup group in New York City devoted to Stanley Kubrick, and a large part of it has been inspired by our Kubrick series. Like, if
really?
You go to their
That's
website,
awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
If you go to their website, which is, where is it? skm-nyc.tumblr.com, Tumblr spelled without an E, you'll see it there. They got all kinds of quotes from our Kubrick series interviews and stuff. You know, these interviews mean a lot to Kubrick fans. So, there it goes. So that's exciting news. The Coen brothers have announced firmly that their next movie is called Hail Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be about the old old studio system. They're shooting a movie like in the 40s or something, I think, in the 50s.
Yeah,
it tells a story
of
like a Hollywood, Hollywood fixer. Like
yeah,
the kind of guy that that what's his name plays, Liv Scribner on that Showtime.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, thank you.
And he's trying to, you know, subdue a controversy on this big movie set. So it should be another great fun movie from them. Interstellar, the second trailer released. Did you see the second trailer?
I saw the trailer online. I haven't seen it in the theater yet, but I did see it online.
Oh,
what
wasn't
are,
on Godzilla?
Any reaction? No. On the few times that I've seen it, no. I get the Transformers. I get Into the Storm. I get, you know, I don't get Interstellar. No, I don't get that.
It looks, the premise didn't really turn me on. I knew it had something to do with corn. Which sounds odd, but it does. And I know that Spielberg was circling this for many years, and he decided not to do it, and that's when Chris Nolan picked it up. But, you know, the trailer looks like it could be a really effective, awesome sci-fi spectacle.
But I agree with you there, and given the premise and everything, though, let me ask you this. Do you think this movie could be a turnoff for a lot of Americans? Given that no one really believes that it seems like our country is going backwards scientifically in some regards, so they don't really buy that this could be a possibility. Where, you know, that scene where in the trailer he said, "Oh, we've run out of food."
Wait a minute, we're not explaining exactly to the people who haven't seen the trailer exactly what is it that seen the trailer as well.
It's the climate.
What?
It's about climate change. It's about
the
world.
Thing. Okay, all right. All right.
Yeah. In the trailer, a guy says to him, we don't have any more food. We've run out of food.
Mm.
That's a scary, scary, scary line. Because we're going down to the basic, we're saying that we hit a tipping point. So...
That's the point that Americans are going to, that you feel Americans are going to cut off when they
Yeah, I think
when
people
hear,
don't
oh,
like
Bob.
To be, people don't believe that this is something that's happening.
Okay.
And I understand that, but this is, if you watched Bill Maher the other night, I was kind of dumbfounded by the amount of people on the panel that didn't believe in this, but my thing is, I like the premise of the movie because it says something that I've believed for a long time. We were, and it goes back to The Right Stuff, if you can indulge me, the speech that Lyndon Johnson gives in The Right Stuff about, you know, that we were, you know, the Romans had the roads, the British had the sea. We were meant to get off the planet. We were meant to go out in different directions and everything. So I'm glad to see Nolan... has gotten all his angst out with The Dark Knight and is going back and is going into something that could fundamentally be a game changer, but I don't know how much of a game changer because we're not, for an industrialized nation, we seem to be stuck in the Stone Age. If you
yeah.
know what I'm saying. I mean, if you understand, I mean,
honestly, all of this stuff, like whether climate change exists or whether it doesn't exist, the debate between us and the rest of the world or whatever, all of that stuff comes down to team sports. Really, it's just all team sports. It's all like, well, we're America and we believe this and so forth and so. If you've ever tried to change somebody from their team that they were on, whether it be a sports team or a religion team or a sexual team or how about a political team, when you're trying to change people's team, things become difficult.
And
no,
so,
they do.
Yeah. They do. You're absolutely right. But I think this film is at least the first film the first film outside of science fiction novels, I should say, that is going to address this because we do need, this may be the only way that we can, how should I say, save our species. There's no law. There's no law that says. I mean, the Earth will rebound without us. It will. The Earth will be able to heal itself without us. There's
No movie is going to save the species. So.
No, but it is something that could awaken people to say, you know, it's very interesting. This whole thing. Oh, we don't have the money to go to space. There was another generation that would have laughed at that. Would have said no. But no, now it's like, oh, we don't have the money to go to space. We don't have the money to save ourselves. You know, what kind of bunk is that? You know, seriously. I mean, think this film, you know, this Dolan might be on to something with this film here. So what do you know about the Blade Runner sequel?
Oh, well, I know that I think that it's a pipe dream and I don't believe it's ever going to happen. And I furthermore don't believe that it's ever going to happen with Harrison Ford. Even if they do it with Harrison Ford, there'll be another Blade Runner that takes over, just like, you know, that takes over in the middle of the movie after Harrison Ford gets his head blown off or something, after Deckard gets his head blown off. There'll be some probably British kid that'll take over the movie. If that even happens, I mean, is there any, like, real precedent? I mean, I'm asking you this, Jerry. Is there any real, I mean, is it based on anything that Philip K. Dick
has done? K.W. Jenner wrote sequels to Blade Runner in the 90s that I remember reading, Replicant Night, and I think there's one other that were very interesting. I hope they're not based on that, not because they're bad books or anything. I would just appreciate a fresh start. I don't think there needs to be a Blade Runner sequel, personally. But you can't say they're doing it for the money, since the first one was not a money maker. There's nothing that says, you know, if I'm looking to make money, the first thing that comes to my mind isn't going to be, hey, let's make a sequel to Blade Runner. Everyone ran out and saw that in droves. No, they didn't. It is the epitome of a cult film.
It is a movie since its release that has entered into the canon in some ways. So.
In some ways, yes, but do you think, let me ask you this though, would you spend the amount of money that they're probably going to spend on this, and you're not going to make that back? I don't see you making
that
back.
Well, it would definitely be a gamble. But what they might do is fuck it up so much that it becomes a huge hit, you know what I'm saying? So
that's true.
So they might go in there and add a lot of elements that wouldn't have been in the original movie, or wouldn't have been even in a sequel that would have been done 3 years after the original movie had it been a hit. They might say, hey, let's go in there and add a Transformers element to it to make it a hit. They might do something. I mean, maybe not Transformers. They'll probably be smarter than that, but they'll definitely be, you know, adding some things into it. And they probably won't base it on those pieces, you know, that you were mentioning, that were the sequels that you were mentioning. But I don't know. I don't really see any real need to do a Blade Runner sequel. I've always said that I don't see why it should be done, really. Why can't we just leave it alone? But listen, if there's $1 to be made out of it, they'll do it. Now we got the Twin Peaks thing.
Now the Twin Peaks thing is very interesting because this is going to have a lot of new footage on it, and from what I'm under the impression of,
just to let everybody know, Twin Peaks is both seasons are coming out on Blu-ray very soon. So,
are you gonna buy it for me? Is someone going to buy? No, not you, but people, if you want to be a really good friend and a really loyal, buy this for me. Thank you. Thank you. I'll come over to your house like George Costanza and watch it with you. You like that, don't you? You know what I'm talking about. Remember that episode?
Yep,
that was a great episode. That was a great episode.
Yeah, no question.
But I will be the Movie Geeks United George Costanza, and I will come over and watch this with you, and you'll probably kick me out after that. We might not even get more than the first 5 minutes, but it'll be a lot of fun. So
it's going to have like a whole lot of a whole lot of, you know, deleted scenes and stuff like that?
Dean, I'm going to the source. I'm going to Cinema Blend, which are friends of ours, and I'm going to see what I can find out here. The Twin Peaks, the entire mystery, a 10-disc Blu-ray set, will come out on July 29th. July 29th. Kids, mark that down in your calendars. I don't care where I am. You can send it to me. I will send you the address and all the information that you need to send it to me. But that's a lot. 10 discs. Wow, that's a great thing. I'm trying to think. But the real kicker here, let me read this exactly, is the Blu-ray debut of Lynch's 1992 prequel feature Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, which will be accompanied by almost 90 high-def minutes of never-before-seen deleted in the alternate scenes.
Mm.
That's
wow.
That's awesome. That's a good deal, guys. I don't care who you are.
Well, if it has, you know, Fire Walk With Me, that'll be the first really complete Twin Peaks compendium that's out there, as far as I know. And
mm-hmm.
I also spent the past week actually watching the second season of Twin Peaks, which is a lot of episodes. You know, it's like 22 episodes.
Oh,
you know,
it's a big deal. It's a big, you know, in the history of 21st century television is written, David Lynch deserves a big round of credit for, you know, really, you know, he did, I think, set the way for what HBO and everyone at FX and Showtime has done.
And AMC,
you know,
everything.
AMC, we can't forget AMC. I mean, because before, what was the first show on AMC? What was the first big show on AMC?
I don't know.
Is it Mad Men? Is it Mad Men?
Yeah.
Yeah. Before that, it had become stood for American Movie Crap. I mean, for the longest time, when they put commercials on and everything, they sort of, you know, diluted their brand. But you know, David Lynch deserves a lot of credit for what he did with TM. It's also John Sayles for Shannon's deal at the same time. Obviously not as successful, but you have to give, you know, tip your hat off to John Sayles for trying to break into TV at the same time as David Lynch. And David Lynch obviously had a lot more success initially. But, you know, we owe David Lynch a lot. This is not to say TV
and
was boring before David Lynch.
Hold on a minute. Not just David Lynch, I have to say. We also have to give proper credit to Mark Frost, who was
you're right.
The show.
Good call.
So I mean, like, you know, those two people together, I think, you know, really, you know, obviously, I mean, you know, what's interesting about Twin Peaks, you know, I mean, we say all the great things about Twin Peaks that everybody has said and everything, you know. And we also, it won't be anything original to say that Twin Peaks loses a lot of its focus in the second season after the initial mystery of who killed Laura Palmer is largely solved. You can feel that there's a sense that the show is searching for some kind of footing, but it also always keeps its eye on the whole idea of evil being a force that's out there in the world that can latch on to anyone
mm-hmm.
who happens to be in its way, and I think that's one of the most interesting things about the second season is that revelation of like how evil is can catch anyone, and I think you know, I mean, that's the second season also has a lot of broad comedy in it.
No, it does. It does. I mean, there's no doubt.
Like,
no doubt about that.
A lot of ridiculous comedy that you wouldn't expect, but some of it works. Some of it doesn't. Some of it's charming, and some of it isn't. I like I love David Lynch's performance in the second season as Gordon Cole. I think that's a
mm-hmm.
really wonderful performance, and I particularly love Heather Graham too, who comes in late in the second season as a waitress at the Twin Peaks Diner, and Right. You know, but, you know, I mean, I don't like the soapy elements to it, you know. I particularly don't like the scenes with, as I didn't in the first series, in the first season, you know. I always found it boring when James Marshall came on, or sometimes Laura Flynn Boyle or whatever, and they were mooning over each other and everything. All that stuff seems really dull to me.
Right.
But it's interesting how they mix it all together, you know, how they mix the dark element and the soapy elements together. It's interesting, you know. It's a little bit of something for everybody in that series.
Oh, yeah. Let me ask you this, though. Now, since we're on the subject of Lynch, will he ever make another movie again?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, you know, he just released an album last year, which I just picked up and I haven't listened to. So that just lets you know that his interest lies elsewhere, I think, these days.
And that's an interesting thing. That's an interesting thing. We never really talk about that on this show, and no one's really. What happens when a filmmaker wants to branch out and do something else? You know, they want to stop making movies.
Well, I think it's the perfect example.
Yeah.
It's a perfect example. I mean, what happens is all dependent on the filmmaker, obviously. But if they have interest in other things, I mean, if they just want to stop making films and start painting pictures or whatever, or they want to stop making films and want to start writing novels, or they just want to make furniture or whatever it is. I mean, they have to have, primarily, they need another interest in something else that fulfills them artistically, I think. And so what happens is all up to them, really. Sometimes they just stop making films and they just sit in their mansion, which they bought from the money that they made from making films, and they just sit there and molder, hoping that they'll make some other films, and maybe a lot of times that doesn't even happen. So,
oh, God, a lot of times it doesn't. But can we imagine someone like a Scorsese? I mean, I think, you know, I was talking to someone about this the other day online, you know, Scorsese made a movie that, you know, for someone his age, you would think of a 30-year-old made, and he still has that fire in the belly, as they say. I mean, his passion is still there.
He has the fire in the belly because he has people who want to see his next movie. But if you have, and then he's going to have, he's kind of like, Scorsese's kind of won the lottery as far as directors or movie directors are concerned, feature film directors are concerned.
And Spielberg, too. Spielberg would be the other one.
I mean, I would say that those two have kind of won the lottery in a sense because they're always going to be able to make movies no matter what, and they'll probably be making movies until they drop dead. And,
right.
I mean, when you go to, like, Coppola or whatever, well, Coppola found something else that he was interested in. He was more interested in his winery and all the other stuff that has come along with that, which, by the way, just to let people know, I, you know, visited with Francis Ford Coppola when he came to Atlanta, and there's an article on filmicability.blogspot.com. My website where you can go and take a look at what Francis Ford Coppola has been up to. But, I mean, like, he's somebody who also has just found other interests. And so, and I think that's the best thing that you can, if you've lost interest in filmmaking, please admit it to yourself and move on. Because I think there's a lot of filmmakers out there that, in their older age, won't admit that they've lost interest, or won't admit that, even if they haven't lost interest, won't admit that, you know, the industry has moved on without me, and there's really no place for me anymore. And so, you know, and that could be a painful truth to some, but it's a truth nonetheless, and it's happened to countless filmmakers before anybody today.
Oh, yeah, I mean, let me ask you this. You know, do you think that happened to William Friedkin?
Well, he's somebody who seemed to have found a little bit more mojo in his later years than maybe. Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible to lose it for a little while and then come back to it. I think that's kind of rare. I think that many of them just sort of peter out. I think that, you know, You know, I mean, but again, you know, movie history is filled with examples of great filmmakers who just petered out and have never really gotten it back again. And, you know, and of course, film history is filled with people who just kept on making movies until they were dead, you know. So, I mean, like, but a lot of the time, you know, a lot of the time what happens is filmmakers just, they get to a certain age and they still have great ideas and still have great connections, and they keep bringing that combination to the people in charge, you know, the executives and so forth. And then they find, oh, nobody's really interested, even though it's a great idea, they're not really interested because my name is not what it used to be.
Right. I mean, would you say that with De Palma or Schrader even, or?
Oh, definitely with those two. Yeah, definitely. I think that they're both struggling. You know, I think that they're both in there still punching and fighting and everything. And obviously they're getting movies out occasionally, but I feel like they're having to go much more unusual routes to get their movies done than they're used to.
Right. No, I agree. That's why I brought up those names, you know, people that we've interviewed, obviously, but just watching the last couple of... Now, I watched Schrader's The Canyons, and I can't find a way to defend that at all. The only Schrader film I haven't watched is Adam Resurrected, just because I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. I've seen all of De Palma's films, and I don't know. I seem to agree with what you just said. But Schrader is working on something as we speak. I don't know. I know he's working on something. And then there's someone like Monty Hellman who's found a court on Facebook, and I don't know if he has anything in the works or not, but he, you know, Criterion, I think, is doing the shooting, and one of his other older movies they're releasing. And he's very... I was going to say it, contemptuous of current movies, and he's not a big Woody Allen fan. He did not like Blue Jasmine.
Yeah, we've talked about that on the show.
Oh, we have. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry to repeat myself.
But with Monty Hellman, I mean, even he's had a couple of movies in the past, you know, five or seven years or whatever, but he makes really tiny movies. You know.
No, he does. And I think he's always happy to get them made, I think, too.
But he makes really tiny movies, the kind of which, you know, theoretically somebody should be able to make one a year.
True.
Somebody with a name like he has. But he also has a name that only the biggest film nuts know, really. The average person doesn't know who Monty Hellman is.
You're absolutely right.
If you went down on the street and you asked 50 people who Monty Hellman is, probably four of them would know.
That's not
the kind of, you know, but that's, you know, look, even when Monty Hellman was at his prime, he wasn't making the movie all the time, you know. So.
No.
He just wasn't. By the way, this is my opinion. My opinion is that anybody who's made great movies in the past, I don't care if they're Monty Hellman or they're John Ford or whoever it is, whoever we're talking about, you know, and people who are still alive today, like De Palma and Schrader, I think they... If I were a movie executive, I would definitely sit down and listen to anything that they had to offer, and I would give serious consideration to it. However, sometimes they don't feel like it's going to make any money, and obviously this is a money business, so what can I do about that?
Right, no.
What can we do about that?
I think we should wrap it up. Is there anything else you want to add? I mean, you had some really interesting stuff on TV to talk about. Is there anything else? I know you've been very busy with your move and everything. Is there anything else that you've had a chance to see or anything? Is there anything else you want to add? Or
No movies, really. I mean, I'm going to sit down tonight, and I'm going to be watching The Unbearable Lightness of Being. And the reason I'm watching that tonight is because I have an article that's due about it in a couple of days for Wonders in the Dark, which is wondersinthedark.wordpress.com, I believe. And tomorrow, Wonders in the Dark is starting their 101 countdown. It's 101 essays, each printed from Monday to Friday each week. On the 101 greatest romantic films, and so I have five articles that are going to appear in that countdown. And the first one I've got to do is Unbearable Lightness of Being, and then the next four I'm going to have to do at the very end, which probably won't happen until October. But I'm also going to do Breaking the Waves, Harold and Maude, Annie Hall, mm-hmm. and my favorite romantic film, which actually didn't make the countdown, but a little romance I'm going to do as a sort of an addendum to the series. But we've got Wonders in the Dark is going to have an incredible lineup of 101 great romantic films, and each of the essays are going to be done by one of our 40 correspondents from around the world. And so that's going to be really good. But other than that, just going to continue pressing on with my personal thing. And then I'll get more down into, get back on the Internet. I've been staying away from the Internet for the past month and a half.
Smart man.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to break from it anyway. But this was the perfect opportunity. So I really won't be back on the Internet until back on Filmicability, putting in articles and so forth, until the beginning of this month, until the move is done. So.
Okay, no, that sounds good. That sounds very good. Okay, I'm just trying to think. I need to set up a separate account for me somehow. There's so many movies on demand now, like on the same day as theaters, that I want to watch. There's a Philip Seymour Hoffman's last film, God's Pocket, which is on demand, which is directed by John Slattery, Roger from Mad Men. That looks
right.
Good. I want to watch. We were going to watch that last night, but no, everyone wanted to watch Orphan Black. Folks, this is why you should live alone. so you can watch God's Pocket. Not that I have anything against Orphan Black, but I went over to watch God's Pocket, but there's that. That's the new James McAvoy film, Filth. I'd like to see that. I'd like to watch, and even though you weren't crazy about it, I'd like to watch The Double. I am curious about that.
Well, watch it at home because you'll want to cut it off after 30 or 40 minutes.
I'll take your word for that, Dean. I'll take your word for that. But, in the next, we have a lot of interesting films coming out, big and small, so we will be talking about all those throughout the course of the summer. And what movie I'm curious about? The Immigrant.
Where is that movie?
That movie's in New York. It opened in New York this weekend, and I think Los Angeles. I'm not positive. I know it opened in New York, but it's a James Gray, Joaquin Phoenix, Marion Cotillard. I'm curious about that. Excuse me.
Mary Cotillard is in the new Jean-Luc Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne movie.
Yeah,
as well.
So, yeah, I want to see that too. I definitely want to see that.
I'm sure, I'll probably be going to the New York Film Festival this year, which I'm really excited about because a lot of the Cannes movies and so forth will probably be there. I'm expecting the new Paul Thomas Anderson to be there. I'm expecting.
That will be done.
It doesn't get a release until December.
Yeah, but it should be. It should be have something to show, a rough cut, if anything.
I mean, by December, I'm sure it'll be ready to show at New York. I'm nearly certain that it will be there. But also, you know, this new Mike Lee movie, which, you know, of course, I'm completely excited about that.
Yeah, Mr. Turner. Mr. Turner,
yeah. Mr. Turner will probably be there. And the new Nuri Bilge Ceylan movie will probably be there, which is apparently like 3.5 hours long. I mean, like, what's the new Ceylan movie called?
Oh, God. I don't know,
called something like Winter Light, but that's not what it is. That's the Bergman movie.
Spell the last name for me, please. Spell the last name.
Ceylan. Are you finding anything?
Yeah, I'm right here. All right, let me. Winter Sleep.
That's it. Yeah. So Winter Sleep, which actually is like kind of like the bookies at Cannes or whatever, who are betting on who's going to win the Palme d'Or, are actually like thinking that Ceylan is going to win it. But of course, we're not there yet. But
right.
But it's something like 3 hours and 18 minutes long, which makes, you know, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia look like The Jerk or
something. Yeah, I have 196 minutes. I have 196 minutes here, so.
Right.
When I am oh my God, okay. All right, on that note, guys, thank you so much for joining us this week, and we will be back next week with an all-new show. Go see something good, and we'll talk to you all soon. Have a great week, everyone.